Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's music row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Marty Stewart has dedicated his life to playing and preserving old country music. During his 40-plus years as a solo artist, Marty has released more than 20 albums and racked up numerous honors, including 5 Grammys and being inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. Marty started his career at the age of 12 playing mandolin in a gospel band. By 21, he joined Johnny Cash's touring band and eventually became a solo artist who combined classic rockabilly sounds with bluegrass and cosmic country. His latest album has a sweeping, spacious feel that's meant to conjure up visions of desert horizons and endless stretches of two-lane highways. For today's episode, Bruce Headlam met up with Marty Stewart at Bridge Studios in Brooklyn. Marty shared stories about first going on the road with the Sullivan Family gospel singers and the very first show he ever played backing Johnny Cash. Marty also talks about how a star-studded studio session with Roy Orbison, Carl Perkins, and Jerry Lee Lewis gave him the confidence to pursue a solo career in country music. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Bruce Headlam with Marty Stewart.
So I do want to talk first about your new album. It's your first one in 6 years?
Altitude, yeah.
So tell me how this one came about. Your albums in the last 15 years have been so, they're like concept albums. They seem so carefully planned. How did this one come about?
Well, this one was ready to go. Me and the band rehearsed it. We were on tour. We were touring with Chris Hillman and Roger McGuinn, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Sweetheart of the Rodeo record. We were doing shows with Chris Stapleton. We were doing shows with Steve Miller Band. And I was just in the presence of these gargantuan songs, just one great song after another, night after night. And I have but it was the Byrds shows that really touched my heart. I love Roger and Chris. They're like big brothers. And the sounds of Roger's 12-string Rickenbacker and my guitar that I played belonged to a fellow named Clarence White that played in the Byrds. Chris Hillman singing and his bass playing. So I have no idea that that did not follow me back to my writing tablet. But we had this record really hot, rehearsed, and ready to go, and then the pandemic crashed in on us. So the idea became, well, we were going to Hollywood, to Capitol Studios, to make the record. They shut down. So we made the decision to soldier through and put on masks and stand 6 feet apart and the drudgery of that in such a space as this. But we got it done, and we sat on the record for over 2 years. So it wasn't quite 6 years. But the pandemic took a bite out of that. But I used my time wisely during that time. Made two more records that are ready to go. So I love making records. I still love making records.
Now tell me about Sweetheart of the Rodeo for you, because, of course, when that first came out, that wasn't popular in Nashville. They got booed at the Ryman famously. Do you remember listening to that growing up? When did you first encounter that record?
I don't think it was popular anywhere. I think even Birds fans went, I don't think we're buying this journey with them. I bought it in a used record, in a record store at a shopping mall in North Nashville in 1973. I remember it was $2.99. I still have the record with the wrapper still on it. And I was playing in Lester Flatt's band at the time at the Grand Ole Opry. And I liked the record because it was the first time that I'd ever heard rock and roll and country and honky-tonk and folk and bluegrass and gospel music collide kind of successfully in the grooves of one record. And so it had an appeal to me because that just something about it worked for me. And right after that, Lester Flatt was kind of a aging Grand Ole Opry star that was loved and highly regarded. He was as one of the master architects of the culture. But if you remember at that particular time, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band had done a record called Will the Circle Be Unbroken that opened up country music and roots music to an entirely different generation of maybe people that went to Woodstock all of a sudden were discovering by way of this hippie band, country music and roots music. And then the movie Deliverance came out and it had that song Dueling Banjos in it, which lit a fire under a lot of people. But Lester had been doing Dueling Banjo in his show for 20 years. And we worked a college buyer showcase in Cincinnati. And the bill that night was Lester Flatt, Chick Corea, and Kool and the Gang. And I thought, man, they're going to laugh us off the stage. But it didn't work that way. We did Dueling Banjos, which was a hot at the moment. And we encored 9 times in 45 minutes. And the next day, his agent booked either 72 or 79 college campuses and rock festivals. One of the first shows we played was at Michigan State, and the opening act was Graham Parsons and Emmylou Harris. Then Lester played it, and the Eagles were out touring Desperado. And I saw Sweetheart of the Rodeo come to life that night. That record that Graham had been a part of, and it had inspired the Eagles, and it inspired me. And I remember going on the bus after the show telling all these old veterans, I just saw the future of my musical life tonight. And I think they looked at me like, yeah, all right, and back to the poker game. But that record had a profound influence on me. It did. That's a long-winded answer, but that's how I got to the Sweetheart.
That's a perfect answer. But you saw Graham Parsons before then. You heard the record, or had you had the record by that point?
I had the record. And he was long gone from the Birds, and I think he was hanging out with the Stones. And I remember he had black fingernail polish on and talking in some, you know, phony Cockney accent a little bit. But there was something. He was an impressive character, and he filled up the room with his presence. And Emmylou was just this angelic kind of hippie girl presence, and I loved her from the get-go. I named her Queenie that night, and she's still Queenie to me. She's my pal.
And you've played with her since. She sang on The Pilgrim.
The Pilgrim. Oh, yeah. Emmylou's like a sister. She is, and she is one of the most fearless musical compadres we have out there, and I find that when I finally get brave enough, you talk about the conceptual records or whatever, when I finally get brave enough to go down the road of some creative endeavor, when I get there, she's already been there. She's one of those. She has just blazed the trail for everybody else.
I love her. I think her first song on The Pilgrim is actually called The Pilgrim. And it's a very different sound for her. It's very commanding and a little operatic in a way that you don't associate with her
singing. It's almost as if you were standing in a cathedral addressing the congregation.
Yeah. And she really, of course, pulls it off because she's Emmylou Harris.
She's Queenie.
What was the thinking going on in this album then? You had these the Sweetheart of the Rodeo songs in your head. It's not an answer to that record. Was it just inspired some of the songs?
I think that maybe the sonics of it, just the attitude or the sounds, guitar sounds, more than anything else. Lyrically, as you well know, you're a writer. You know, the blank page is the biggest spot on planet Earth when there's nothing on it. And songs just kind of come down from the sky. And all of a sudden, I mean, I probably left 15 songs behind, but there was a collection of songs that seemed to hold together. And I don't know that there was an exact theme that ran through this record, but it was just a vibe more than a theme. But I think lyrically, it holds up okay.
Mm-hmm. And the sound is beautiful.
Thank you.
But a lot of your records sound beautiful, and I mean this as the highest compliment. They sound like records. They sound like great records. You can hear the studio. When the drums come in the first track, they sound like real drums. It's nice to hear.
Yeah. And I tell you, I'm surrounded by four guys on stage and an engineer named Mick Conley. We are tone freaks. We will go to the ends of the earth searching for yet a better tone. And I think the thing that's missing in a lot of records these days is air. The room is supposed to be a band member and a voice. And just understanding air and space in records makes a whole lot of difference sometimes. It took me a long time to get there. And less is sometimes a whole lot more.
How do you do that? Is it peeling away tracks? Is it listening to the room? I know what you mean by that, but I couldn't tell you how you'd get there.
Do you remember the great jazz singer Peggy Lee?
Oh, yeah.
One of the greatest of all time. I can only imagine going to see Peggy Lee at the right place in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And I would think that she was cool as ice. And I would think by the second note, you're right. She brings you right to her. Right? Mm. Did you ever get to see her?
Never saw her.
Oh, man.
I've got the records.
Well, me too. Me too. And I read one time that she talked about going to the studio. She said, hey, we didn't go to the studio and look for chances. We knew what we were going to do when we got to the studio. And I like to rehearse it up to a point, leave maybe 5% for magic to find its way in and surprises. But Peggy Lee's records were one of those, and we just keep going. Dave Brubeck records, you know, I listened to all that stuff. But the sonics on those records are just so lush, and they're so warm, and they touch your heart. And they just seem to check off all the boxes, and, you know, it's a lifelong mission to try to get there.
Is it harder to do recording digitally?
Not necessarily. There's a whole lot of value in tape and analog. I love that, but it's slower. You better be well rehearsed, and it's hard to edit if you make a mistake, you know, that kind of stuff. But I just think if you have a great band, a great song, good instruments, great engineers, great microphones, and a room that sounds good, if you play it right, what can go wrong? If you capture it right, it's not rocket science. It's just having a great piece of material is the first and foremost thing, though.
Oh, it's rocket science, I think. Or magic. What was the room? Where did you record this?
We recorded this at East Irish Sound, which is the old House of Blues studio in Nashville, which, you know, the room we're sitting in right now, it has a music vibe to me. This is a creative box. And so many studios are gorgeous and they cost a gajillion dollars and they're stiff and they're sterile. But I love rooms like this that are just a little bit funky, that invite you in and say, you know, come on, show me what you got.
This was an old bean sprout factory.
Was it?
Initially, yeah. This was a Chinese part of town.
How about that?
So they grew, because you can grow bean sprouts in the dark. So they would have these big pools with bean sprouts growing
up. That's awesome.
So, yeah.
Well, you go back to rooms like Sun Records in Memphis. It's, you know, half the size of this room probably. But there's something magic in those walls. The little studio down in Muscle Shoals, where they made so many great records. Studio B in Nashville. It's just a cinder block building that was built for $30,000, but it still sounds better than everybody else's $20 million rooms for some reason. There's just some rooms can't be explained.
You do sound like Paul Simon, because he was obsessed with the slapback in the Sun studio, and he would play it for us and say, there are no drums on this record. I know it sounds like there is, but there isn't. So,
my friend Cowboy Jack Clement was the engineer down there for many years, and he talked about when they would put out a record and it didn't sell, of course they would return it to Sun, and all of a sudden he says there just kept becoming this growing number of boxes along the walls of returned records, and the studio kept getting smaller and smaller. And one day Sam Phillips came and said, get those out of here. And when he did, it changed the sound. I said, get them back in here, whatever it takes.
People often talk about the Beatles' influence on you. I don't know if you've ever really spoken about it, but you can certainly hear it in certainly a lot of your older songs. Were they an influence growing up for you?
No.
That's interesting.
That's really strange. I was a really, really late Beatles bloomer. You couldn't avoid it. because they, you know, ruled the planet. But in the early 60s, when they were taking off, the first three records I ever owned was Meet the Beatles, The Fabulous Johnny Cash, and Flatten Scruggs' Greatest Hits. And the Beatles entertained my feet. The other two entertained my heart. And I gave my Beatles record away.
Wow.
And I always liked their songs, but I never went deep. And there's all three of the guys in the Superlatives are Beatles aficionados. And so they kind of drew me in the last 4 or 5 years, actually.
Is that right?
Actually. And I started listening to the Beatles channel on satellite radio. And what I noticed immediately was the quality of the songs, just mm-hmm. the power and the timelessness of the songs. And the other thing I noticed, you mentioned the drum sound on this new record, was the sound of Ringo's drums. And I was astounded to find out that there are people out there that didn't think Ringo was a great drummer. It's like, come on, give me a break. He played the song. He is a brilliant drummer. And we worked really hard on this record. I think the song was Sitting Alone. I said, make it sound like Ringo's drums, and we're there. Mm-hmm. And I think Harry Stinson accomplished that with the engineer, Nick, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Ringo is left-handed playing a right-handed set, so mm-hmm. he's always a little late. Like he plays late on the beat because he's got to get his right hand out of the way, which just makes that sound. You know, certainly when I hear Don't Leave Her Lonely or Thanks to You, I hear a real kind of Beatles thing. So I'm amazed
it got on me, it was just, again, because of the volume of their work and the intensity of their work throughout the universe. But I truly became a Beatles fan in the past 5 years. And I loved the film Get Back. Mm. Was that the name of it? The documentary? I watched the whole thing. And just, again, to see the process of the songs come together so fast and the amount of work they put into them. And I tell you what else drew me into the Beatles. I had a night off. We were on the road in Vegas. I went to see Love.
Mm-hmm.
That production out there and the way they used Beatles songs and Giles Martin's remixing of those songs and just the way they brought it in. And I left there, again, it was just another layer of wonder going, how did those boys do that? I look at their body of work, Hank Williams' body of work, and those kind of guys, Jimi Hendrix, they weren't here very long. And what they left behind, I don't know how you live up to that kind of work that comes that fast and is that profound.
Your music came fast. You were like a prodigy when you were a kid. What started first, the mandolin or the guitar?
Guitar. I loved the guitar. My hero was Luther Perkins, who played in Johnny Cash's band. Roy Nichols, who played in Merle Haggard's band. Ralph Mooney, who played the steel guitar out there at those times. Those were the guys that I kind of kept my eye on as a kid. I loved the Ventures, loved surf music. Don Rich, who played with Buck Owens. Those were Telecaster Cowboys, and I liked what they were up to. And then when I was 12 years old, I bought a 78 RPM record at a junk store of Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys Quartet, and I fell in love with the mandolin. And my guitar went under the stereo for 2 or 3 years, and I went to the mandolin. But that part of it seemed to kind of come naturally. But as the here comes the songwriting layer, then here comes you have to learn to sing layer, then produce records if you're mm-hmm. going to do it. So it's been a lifelong process.
Was your family musical? What led you to the guitar?
My grandpa Stuart was a scratchy old Mississippi backwoods fiddle player.
Oh, okay.
And my mom played a little piano at church, and everybody loved music at our house more than they played it. But our home on Saturday nights, when I started playing, people in the community would come by and we would play country music, you know, sing those kind of songs. And after church on Sunday night, sometimes people would come to our house for coffee and there was a piano and they would sing gospel songs. So there was always music floating around the house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then how did you end up touring with Lester Flatt?
I went on the road in the summer of 1972. I was 12 years old and there was a regional band called the Sullivan Family Gospel Singers, who were bluegrass gospel singers. And they had a television broadcast that came from Jackson, Mississippi. And they were cool-looking people, and they played spirited music. And I just kind of liked the Sullivan's thing. And my buddy Carl Jackson, who was a professional musician in that part of Mississippi, was playing some shows with them. And they played a church about a mile from our house. And I called Carl and said, do you think Mr. Sullivan would let me get up and play a song on the mandolin? He said, well, I'll ask him. And the word came back, yeah, come on. So I played that night, and people applauded and stomped their feet for me, and I got the bug. And as the summer approached, Carl said, I said, what are you doing this summer? I'm going to go out and play shows with the Sullivan family. They were playing camp meeting revivals and bluegrass festivals and George Wallace campaign rallies. And I said,
is that right?
Yeah. I said, do you think that I could go along? He said, well, I'll ask. And so that was my stepping off place into the world of going on the road. So I was 12 years old. And that summer, I toured with the Sullivan family gospel singers throughout the back roads of the South. And we played those places I just talked about. And I discovered applause, the spotlight. You can talk about music 24 hours a day. You can wear your hair and your clothes any way you want to and be around bohemian people that know nothing other than music, 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 music. And I fell in love with all that summer and probably made $21, I don't know.
And you were on the bus every night?
Well, they were in a car. There were six of us in a station wagon with the bass fiddle in there and the records and the costumes.
Wow.
And I thought it was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. I would have paid to be in there. And so at the end of that summer, I had to go back home and go to school. And it was like being dropped off by the circus at the edge of town. And it killed me. It killed me because I knew that the band was out there playing. There was applause and girls and needed autographs signed, you know, the big things of life. And about 2 weeks into the ninth grade, I was falling apart. I was a pitiful excuse for a student. I took a country music song roundup, which was a popular publication at the time, stuck it in the middle of my history book, and I was reading it. And my history teacher snuck up behind me, or just kind of eased up behind me, and knocked it out of my hand. She said, if you'd get your mind off that garbage and get your mind onto history, you might make something of yourself. To which the genius replied, I'd rather make history than learn about it. Dismissed.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
Dismissed. So I went home and called my mom, and I called a buddy of mine who worked with Lester Flatt at the Grand Ole Opry, who I'd met on the circuit the previous summer. He said, call me sometimes. Maybe you could ride the bus with us. And so I begged. Lester said yes, and I begged for one weekend to go up to Nashville. And I went on the bus with Lester Flatt and his guys to Glasgow, Delaware, to a bluegrass festival for 2 days. And Lester heard me playing in the back of the bus, and he put me on the show. And the crowd liked it, and I could see his wheels turning, old businessman going, oh, new kid, new energy, you know. And at the end of the weekend, he offered me a job, and next thing I know, I was gone. That was it.
That was it. That was that day in history class, your last day of school?
Mm-hmm. I was supposed to take a correspondence course, which was pretty useless.
Mm-hmm.
So I've since become a Rhodes Scholar, Bruce.
What were you playing? Were you soloing back then on the mandolin? Were you singing?
I was playing mandolin and guitar. I played guitar because Roland White played the mandolin, and they would hand me the mandolin and feature me on a couple of tunes. And I think what sealed the deal is Lester played at the Grand Ole Opry, and I begged my parents to let me stay one more weekend, and Lester said I could play at the Grand Ole Opry with him. He had offered me this job, and they were going, no, 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 you have to come back and go to school. But no self-respecting family in the South would deny their child a place on the Grand Ole Opry, you know. So they let me play, and at the end of the song, the crowd just kept applauding and just kept applauding. And I thought I'd done something wrong. I looked at Lester. I said, what do I do? He said, do it again. And so we encored, and my family met with him the next weekend, and they worked out all the arrangements, and I went to work.
Man, what kind of guy was he?
Lester was like a country preacher, perhaps. He was cool as Miles Davis, laid back. Again, one of the master architects of the whole culture, one of the pioneers of it all. He'd been there, seen it, done it all. And I don't think my mom and dad would let me go on the road with a metal band, but with him, it was a different set of circumstances. And he and his wife welcomed me into their home because my folks still lived in Mississippi and continued to do so for a couple of years. And they made me feel welcome, and I was looked after and taken care of. And, you know, business was business. Money went back home to my mom. I got to keep a little bit every week to buy records and eat with. But that was, you know, it was a structured deal.
Mm-hmm.
He taught me the business of the music business.
What'd you learn about the business?
He and Earl Scruggs, when they were partners, and you have to remember, this is at a time when the country music industry was playing in schoolhouses and fairgrounds and, you know, Grange halls and civic auditoriums. There was none of this stuff that's happening now. There was nothing corporate about the country music world. It was an industry by all means, and it was a well-organized industry, but it was a mom-and-pop industry. But Lester was one of those guys that taught me, if I owe you a nickel, you know, you pay me. But if he owes me a nickel, he's going to come across town to give it too. And he gave me a great piece of advice on the day he hired me. He said, it's not about coming to this town or anybody's town and being the most popular person and taking all the money and all the awards and being forgotten in 2 years. He said, what you really want to work on is being welcome every January the 1st and being a part of the whole story. I went, yes, sir. And I knew what he was talking about. But whether it was money or that kind of advice or just how to run a show, how to make records, whatever, Lester was at the forefront of a lot of that thing. And he was just one of I would think it would be a lot of luck hanging out with Louis Armstrong. He could tell you about anything you needed to know from a hard-earned perspective.
Yeah. Did he ever talk about his days with Earl Scruggs?
All the time. All the time. They had a bitter breakup in 1969. And Lester was one of those guys, when he told a story, it was word for word. If he told it 40 times, I go, here comes the comma. Here comes the next word. He told it verbatim, so you could hang your hat on it. And I knew that he and Earl, just creative differences, it had run its course. They had been partners since the 40s. They started together in Bill Monroe's band, then they emerged from there and became Flat and Scruggs, arguably the most successful bluegrass duo in history, and set all the standards that we still follow. But the times ran their course. But I knew that they were basically the same guy in a lot of ways. I knew that they had helped invent each other's persona. I knew that they had helped write the rules to show business. I knew there was a lot in common. And Lester got sick when he was 63. He died when he was 64. And Bob Dylan came through town. I went to see him, and he said, did Lester and Earl ever talk anymore? I went, they're always going to get around to it, but that never quite happens. And Bob said, that's sad. Abbott and Costello were that way. The little fat guy was going to go see the other guy, and it never happened. And this feeling came, and Lester was in the hospital. And this feeling came up in my stomach when Bob said that, and I said, I got to go. And I went outside to a payphone, and I got Earl Scruggs' number. And I did not know Earl Scruggs. I had never met him. It was the other camp. It was the enemy camp, right? But I called, and Earl's wife, Louise, who was the manager, and a really cold, you know, act on the telephone. I said, Louise, this is Marty Stewart. I'd like to talk to Earl. What about? I said, it's personal. Earl came on the phone. I said, Earl, this is Marty Stewart. He said, I know who you are. He said, I like your playing. I listened to you. I went, thank you, sir. I said, I really need to come talk to you. So I left Bob's show and went out to see Earl and Louise, and it was like sitting in a museum because they were just sitting there viewing a painting. And I said, Lester's dying. I said, I don't know that he'll make it through the weekend. I said, I think the last thing in this world that needs to happen is for him to leave this earth without you guys saying bye. And I was shaking I was scared.
How old were you?
I was maybe 17, 18.
Wow.
And I was shaking. I was shaking. And I said, if you need the halls cleared, I'll go to work on it. Whatever you need. I said, but if you would see fit to go see him, I think it's great. He said, I'll think about it. And I wrote down the room number. And the Lester's band, we had to go out and play 3 concerts that the promoter wouldn't let us out of. We went as Lester's band. So when we pulled back in the parking lot, Lester's manager was standing there waiting on the bus 3 days later, and he had tears in his eyes. He said, but Earl went and saw Lester. And they settled up on the way out. And so that was a good story. That was a good ending to that story. I'm glad I got to be a small part of that.
That's a great story. After that, you played with a couple of people. You played with Vassar Clemens, who's this sort of fascinating character. Can you tell me a little bit about him?
I fell in love with Vassar by way of that Nitty Gritty Dirt Band record, Circle Be Unbroken, Volume 1. He just played this bluesy style of fiddle that I had never heard before. And coming from Mississippi, you know, everything starts with the blues. And he put the blues and bluegrass to me. Very soulful. And I met him, and he was easy to hang out with. But Vassar was off into this. He'd been playing some with the Grateful Dead. He'd been playing some with the Circle record made him a star with all these, you know, younger bands and cool bands. And anybody would welcome Vassar to come hang out and play with him. But he had this country jazz fusion thing going. And I wanted to get away from bluegrass and start spreading my wings. And so, but Vassar still understood bluegrass because that's where he came from. So I bought an electric guitar and did not know how to play it, but he gave me a job. I don't know why, but I worked with him for a few minutes, and we crossed paths with Dr. Merle Watson on the road that summer. And I asked Merle Watson if I could come hang out, so I worked with them for a while.
You and sold your electric guitar?
No, I can't. No, okay. And still went back under the stereo. That's where it always goes. Then Johnny Cash's gig came along. So those, really, Lester and Johnny Cash are the only two steady gigs I ever had, which goes back to the first two records I ever owned.
And how did that come about with Johnny Cash?
I had one day left with Doc and Merle Watson. We were in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. It was a two-show day. And I went back to the hotel, and I had no idea after I flew back to Nashville where I was going to head, what I was going to do. There was a guitar player, great guy named Lonnie Mack, had called me about maybe talking to him. And I was like, yeah, and I was flirting with going to California to see if Bob Dylan would hire me as a band member. And all those were just blue sky deals. But I went back to the hotel after the first show in Cedar Rapids, and remember when hotel phones had red lights on them, like there was a message at the front desk, and it was from my mom. And she said, Johnny Cash's guitar player, Bob Wooten, is looking for you. And I had met John a few weeks previous to that at Cowboy Jack Clement's studio. A buddy of mine had built him a guitar, and I kept up with the progress of the guitar and went with him to deliver it just to meet my old hero. And so we hit it off. John and I absolutely hit it off that first handshake. He just kept shaking my hand. He go, where you been? I went, getting ready. He said, where are you from? I went, Mississippi, when I thought so. And lightning kind of struck, and it just, we were pals immediately. And back to the Doc and Merle Watson thing. So Bob called Bob Wooten. He says, John wants to know if you'd be interested in going to work in our band. I went, absolutely. I said, when are you thinking about me starting? He went, how about tomorrow? He said, where are you? I went, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I said, where are you guys? He went, Des Moines, Iowa. So it was a two-hour rental car ride, and I went over there to the hotel, showed up. He said, we have a matinee show. So I go into the lobby, and Bob Wooten met me, got me settled in. He said, we leave here, you know, 1 o'clock or whatever the deal was. And I went and sat down in the restaurant, and the maitre d' came and said, Mr. Cash is on the phone for you. And I went, all right. So I got up. He said, hello, son. How are you? I went, fine. Glad to be here. He said, we're glad to have you. He said, do you have anything black to wear? I went, probably. And he said, do you know all my songs? I went, probably. Do you still do them in the same key? And he went, probably. And he says, well, good. He says, I'm probably going to take a nap, and I'll probably see you in a few minutes. Click. And that was it. And the next thing I know, I'm on stage, and he walked out and said, hello, I'm Johnny Cash. And we went. I was in. That was the whole deal.
Were you playing the lead parts?
No, Bob Wooten was playing the lead, and I took a mandolin, and I had my acoustic guitar and my electric guitar with me, and he asked me if I played the fiddle. I went, oh, yeah. And it was a total lie, but I wasn't
going to. You never played the fiddle?
Barely.
Same tuning as a mandolin.
Yeah, but still, as you know, it's another world.
Yeah, it's under
but he played this song called Orange Blossom Special, and it's always played in the key of E. But he does it in the key of C because he played the harmonicas on it. But somehow a fiddle appeared, and I mean, when I started playing it, it was awful. It was god-awful. And he looked at me like he's, I could see him thinking, I thought you said you could play a fiddle, but I wasn't going to lose the job because I couldn't play a fiddle. But the best part about it, at the end of that first tour, I get this check in the mail for, you know, the work. And a letter, dear son, thank you, glad you're with us. You know, you add life and vibrancy to the show, blah, blah, blah. But at the end, love, JR. And then it says, P.S. to all fiddle squeaker, just yours.
Now, I heard a story once that you lost that fiddle.
Jerry Lee.
To Jerry Lee Lewis.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
We were on tour in Paris. And I decided it was Carl Perkins, John, and Jerry Lee Lewis. The tour was called The Survivors. So we go around Europe and all, you know, playing all these shows, and their fans are coming out. And I called Jerry Lee Uncle Gerald. So I decided somewhere along the way that I was going to see if I could keep up with Uncle Gerald roaring. And I made it about 2 days, and we were in some hotel in France. And I remember thinking the world started going round and round, and I started seeing four of everything where there was only one. I thought, I have to surrender. I said, I have to go to bed. He says, well, all right. And so he was still going, the room full of people. And I went to my room, and maybe an hour later or something, there was this knock on the door. And he comes to the door, and he has no shirt on, and he is covered in chocolate cake. He says, can I borrow your fiddle? Okay. Sure. So I called, you know, the guy that looked over the gear, and I said, would you deliver my fiddle to Jerry Lee's room? And I have not seen it since.
You never asked him?
No, I knew better than to ask. But I tell you what I did. I did see recently, I was going through Jerry Lee Lewis pictures on Google, and I saw a picture of him playing my fiddle. And that's the last time I saw it. I have no idea beyond that. So
what happened? What kind of guy was he?
Well, to me, he was Uncle Gerald, and he was one of the greatest stylists and musicians and singers and interpreters of all time. But it would have been a big ride to, you know, have to manage all the ducks in his wheelhouse every day. I think he would have been, as Levon says, an adult-sized portion of putting up with things. He was just, I don't think he knew what was going to happen when he woke up in the morning. He just got up and he went about being Jerry Lee, and things crossed his path. But there are people that I know that were with him for many, 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 many years, and they loved him, respected him. And, you know, I think the Jerry Lee persona was one thing, but when you get into the realm of family, was he was to me, it was a different guy.
What kind of guy was he in that context?
He was spiritual, very spiritual, mm-hmm. very soulful, humble, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. He was a mild person at heart. He truly was when it got into his family. He had a big heart.
We have to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more from Bruce Hedlum and Marty Stewart. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet, but you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest. We're back with more from Marty Stewart.
I watched an interview with your great guitar player, Kenny Vaughan, and he talked about starting on the electric, how that's different than people who start with acoustic and then cross over. What was it like for you to learn the electric guitar?
Well, it's an ongoing process. It's a completely different feel, a completely different language. The notes are the same, but how you touch it and approach it. And I think there's so many gifted guitar players out there. I mean, I love the guitar because you can truly express when you figure out who you are and what you want to say with it. It's a great way to. Has its own language.
The electric does.
The electric, it yeah. does. I mean, I listen to people like Pop Staples, who's one of my favorite guitar players. Pops was so basic, but he used that tremolo on his guitar, and it was like Moses spoke when you heard the Staples singers come on the air. It was just, again, back to less is more. Pops was a very minimal guitar player, but his guitar playing was so vast and profound. Then you hear a guy like, I saw a clip the other day of Eddie Van Halen doing sound check out here on the street in Manhattan somewhere before they played, and people hanging out the windows because it was so loud and thrilling, all those notes flying by. It must have been like 40 fighter jets flying by at the same time or something. But and Kenny's another one of those. He started as an electric player, and I've watched him grow as an acoustic player. And I know that he would say the same thing about my electric playing as we, but we work at it. We work at it all the time.
Mm. You practice every day?
No, I doodle. Kenny practices, I doodle.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you doodle pretty well because your guitar player.
Some players are better than others.
You've got Pop Staples' guitar.
I do. And it's in town. Tomorrow night, I'm doing a song with Wynton Marsalis, with Jazz at Lincoln Center on a show that he's doing. And he asked me to do Will the Circle Be Unbroken? That old War Horse anthem. But beyond the Carter family's original recording, the Staples Singers version is my favorite song, is my favorite version. And I brought Pop's guitar with me. It's in this very room. It's here with us today.
What kind of guitar? It's
a Fender Rosewood Telecaster. And it's the one, if you looked at the movie The Last Waltz, the band did the song The Wait with the Staples Singers. That's the one.
Mm-hmm. And he's got such a, I mean, you know, people say, well, he only knew the E chord.
He didn't need to know anything else.
He made it sound.
When he went. That's Pops.
And is it all gospel sort of playing or is it?
Well, it sounds like rock and roll to me. But it's he called it gospel guitar, but it's just soulful. It's soul guitar.
It's got such a beautiful sound. Is he just using a tremolo? What's he doing?
I called him one time to come to Nashville, and he agreed to do it. He said, "Nah, I'm gonna need two things." I said, "What do you need, Pops?" He says, "I need me a Fender amplifier with some shake on it, and a stretch out car." I went, "No problem." And I called Mavis. I said, Mavis, help me. What is a Fender 65 amp with some shake on it? She said, oh, Marty, that's tremolo. I went, okay. And I said, and what is a stretch out car? She said, oh, that's one of them limousines. Pops like limousines. Well, got it. No problem.
You didn't know a Fender amp?
Well, I didn't understand what shake meant.
Oh,
I thought
okay.
I did, but yeah. I didn't want to take any chances. So I found that was Pop's word for tremolo.
And it was a 65.
65 with some shake on it.
Uh-huh. Wow. Okay. Did it sound good?
Oh, of course it did. Pops was one of those guys who could play 40 guitars and 40 different amps, but they all sounded the same. It was in his hands.
Mm-hmm. Are you that kind of player?
I don't think so. Not to that level, no.
Mm-hmm. You also got Carl Perkins' guitar, is that right?
Yeah.
Tell me the story about that.
At the end of the Johnny Cash band member days, there was a happening in Memphis called the Class of 55 Sessions. Record producer named Chips Moman was trying to light a fire under Memphis. Memphis was trying to reestablish itself and freshen its image up and step out in the 80s. And so Chips put together this series of recording sessions with Carl Perkins, Johnny Cash, Roy Orbison, and Jerry Lee. And of course, I was right in the middle of that because I was in John's band and I wanted to see that. I was in it. So I played on those sessions. And the word was out that I was looking for, you know, a pathway forward and to try to be a recording artist and to try to be a country and western singing sensation. First person that heard about it was Sam Phillips. And he came up to me and said, is that what you have on your mind? I went, yes, Unc. And he says, does Johnny know about this? I went, absolutely. He supports it. He says, okay. He gave me his blessing. And then Carl heard about it. And he says, is this what you're going to do? I went, yeah. So at the end of the sessions, he walked up and handed me his Fender Stratocaster that he had been playing and autographed it on the back. He said, to me, it was like being knighted or something. It was a rite of passage. It was like all those guys surrounded me and gave me their support. And that tipped me off.
Wow. What was it like being in those sessions?
Well, it was the one question that kept being asked was, wouldn't it be great if Elvis was here? I mean, journalists descended from all over on those sessions. I mean, I wish you could. The best part of the sessions, in reality, Bruce, was the press conference. They held the press conference at the Peabody Hotel. And to see those four guys, along with Cowboy Jack Clement and Sam Phillips, walk in to the Peabody Hotel and take a seat behind the conference table for a press conference, it was a mighty thing to see those guys that left town as young princes come back as these kings. I mean, it was an electric thing. But the question that kept coming up that week was, you know, wouldn't it be great if Elvis could be here? And of course, Roy Orbison had a very eloquent answer, and, you know, well, in spirit, he still is. And John had a wonderful answer, you know, and Carl would get a tear in his eye and tell his story, leave it to Jerry Lee. And Jerry Lee said, well, he would be if he hadn't overshot the runway. But there was a renegade spirit about that week that never quite made it into the grooves of that record. It didn't have the sass that the Sun Records that you and I probably grew up listening to had, but still, Dick Clark and his team came in from California to document all that stuff. But still, just to be a fly on the wall and turn the volume down just to watch it was worth its weight in gold.
Yeah. Where was Johnny Cash in his career at that point? We know his kind of, you know, Rick Rubin, who's a partner in the podcast, had his moment with Johnny Cash, which is a bit later. Because of that, people have reinterpreted his later career as, well, he was struggling or his record label is going to drop him. How was he as a performer then? What was he like?
He was a master performer. That never wavered. He was a master showman. And he was a man of integrity. He left this earth looking for one more song. Those things never varied. What I was taken by on the first night in Des Moines, Iowa, the Johnny Cash that I adored as a kid and that became my hero was the guy that made the Folsom Prison record and the guy that defied authority and the guy that made the Bitter Tears record to bring light to the Native American plight. the San Quentin record, all those edgy things, the concept records that he did, Ballots of the True West, Johnny Cash Visits the Holy Land. You never knew what he was going to do next, and it was so interesting. But the night of Des Moines, Iowa, when I signed on and went to the hotel that night, I had to have a talk with myself because I really had not seen his concert since 1970 when I was a kid. And I thought, I think I just signed on to the Lawrence Welk show. It was a really broad family atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
The guy that was my hero from those records past, he was down in there somewhere, but I didn't see much evidence of him. But I still, even his Spare Change was better than most everybody else's stuff. Yeah. And I knew that it was the best opportunity that I ever had in my life, and I knew that I was going to go ahead and go for this and take it hook, line, and sinker. But I was really surprised at how mild it had become. He was Patriot Cash. He could still fill up performing arts centers. He could still fill up state fairs, grandstands. But that edgy guy was gone. And I didn't see that edgy guy until we went to Europe the first time. He still did a lot of business in Europe. But in Europe, I went, okay, I see there's another wave out there somewhere for John R. Cash. Because it was kids. He was still a pop star over there. And it was these rockabillies and tattooed kids and punks, along with the servicemen who were a long way from home and the audience that had grown up with him since the 50s. There was an edge to that audience, and I thought, one of these days that's going to make it back to the States. But we would go back over there, and I could see what was coming. And from day one, I went in as an advocate of, we need to go back to the original sound. I went to him one day and said, you need to fire me. You don't need me. You don't need two horn players. You don't need a synthesizer player. You don't need a piano on stage. You need you and three guys on stage. He said, well, a lot of people depend on me. I said, well, there's your problem. I said, get it back to the music. And I think it hurt his feelings and took him back a little bit, but I was always honest about that. And I'd go, I don't need to play on this. But one day, long after I had left his band, I went out with his blessing and got started, had a false start, and got my band started. We started having hits. And things started going in the right direction for me. But he called me and said, can you come out to the House of Cash in the morning? I said, yeah. So I went out there, and he opened up a little 6.5-ounce bottle of Coca-Cola and set it in front of me. He said, don't talk to me for 21.5 minutes. I went, all right. And he sang me 10 or 12 songs, just him and his guitar. And when he got through, I could tell he was kind of looked at me like, what do you think? I said, what did I just hear? He said, my new album. I said, you mean just you and your guitar? He said, yeah, what do you think? I said, I think it's brilliant. It goes beyond what you've ever done, and you're the best storyteller that's ever lived. You and a guitar and a 3-minute song that says the right thing, nobody can deny that and walk away from it unchanged. And then he told me about Rick Rubin and what he was up to, and I went, absolutely brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Well, you have some story songs, and you've got some story albums. Is there something you could get from the way, other than he was Johnny Cash? How did he tell that story? How did he pull people in so well?
In his case, I think it was they trusted the messenger. We all trusted the messenger. Hank Williams had that. Merle Haggard had that. There's Bruce Springsteen has it. When Bob Dylan wants to, he's, you know, one of the greatest that ever was at it. That's part of the fan artist dance, is finding somebody you trust with your heart.
Mm.
And at the end of the whole episodic thing that we worked on with Ken Burns for the country music series for PBS, Ken and I agreed that beyond everything else we talked about, it's the stories. It's the stories that matter the most. And John just happened to have that gift. His voice was like, you know, thunder coming from the middle of the earth. And his 3-chord treatment of most of those songs was like anybody could look at him and relate to what he was saying. Even if you didn't like his singing or appreciate what he was up to, he was one of those, he had a presence about him that you had to at least consider. And if you did, it usually made a difference in your heart.
Wow. When you said he was in Europe and the audiences were different and they were responsive in a different way. Did it change his performance at all?
Yeah. He went back and did older songs that I longed to hear him sing as a Johnny Cash fan. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, look at here. He's doing The Legend of John Henry's Hammer. He's doing I Was There When It Happened, So I Guess I Don't Know. He's doing Greystone Chapel. He's doing Delia. He's doing, you know, Sing It Pretty Sue. He's doing all those kind of songs that he would never do in the States for some reason. And he'd get around to all those old Sun records and like, yeah, come on.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. When did you know you wanted to go out and be a solo artist?
One of my best friends in the world was Fluke Holland. Fluke was drummer in the Johnny Cash Band. Fluke's great distinction was that he started out playing with Carl Perkins. He didn't own a set of drums. He borrowed a set of drums, and they used him to drive to Memphis to Carl Perkins' best because he had a car.
that's the secret to all drummers.
Absolutely.
They have the car.
But check this out. So Fluke's first recording session and the first song he ever played on in his life was Blue Suede Shoes by Carl Perkins. And, you know, the Tennessee Three, Luther Perkins, Marshall Grant, and Fluke Holland, they were my Stones. They were my Beatles. And Fluke, when I joined Cash's band, it took me 2 seconds to go, Fluke, you're my best friend, and I want to know everything there is to know about you and hang out with you. You're cool. But Fluke was one of those that had been in that show for 20-something years at that time. He joined in 1961, so this would have been 1980, whatever that is. And we'd sit in the coffee shop and talk about, you know, music and careers and things. And Fluke would always say, if you want to be me, you can stay here for the rest of your life and one day you won't have a job. But at some point, you need to go out there and see what it's all about. And I knew he was right. And he encouraged me. And the Johnny Cash Show was a spawning ground and a launching pad for other stars, people that went on to become stars. And I knew that it wasn't a foreign concept. And so John was behind it. He knew that look in my eye. And there came a point where it was the hardest thing in the world to go, I got to go try this. But I did it with his blessing. The way it kind of worked out is that show hadn't had a hit in a lot of years. And I took a song called The Highwaymen to sessions that John and Willie were going to do a record. And it wasn't quite clicking. And we had just come from Switzerland where John, Willie, Waylon, and Christofferson had done a show together. And they wound up in a hotel room after the filming, passing the guitar around, and it was magic. So we got back to the States. Johnny Willie was going to make a record, and it wasn't really magic. And I went to my cousin who worked at Glenn Campbell's publishing company, and I was aware of a song called The Highwaymen that Jimmy Webb had written, but I did not know the song. I just liked the title. And he played it for me. On a break from the sessions, I went, 4 verses, no harmony required. This could work. I took it back to the studio, and I played it for John and Chip's moment. And John said, play it again. I said, no harmony needed. And John, on the second page, says, I want that verse about Starship. Of course, it's the first 4th verse. That's when Marlon Brando comes up out of the river, right?
Right.
Master Showman.
Yeah.
And next thing I know, there's a hit in the house. Well, Columbia Records took notice, and John was very adamant about pointing me out to the Columbia Record people. This is the kid that brought that song. And I just happened to have a tape to start putting on people's desks at that time. So,
you know, when those were your Columbia Records. Your big record started with MCA.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed as though you came out and Dwight Yoakam and some other people, but your sound sounded like you've been thinking about this your whole life. Was that the sound you were looking for? Is that what you were trying to find? Or were you still looking around trying to find?
I was kind of feeling my way through the dark a little bit at the very first of the MCA sessions. There had been a misfire at Columbia. I did a record, and the second record I put out, I turned it in and I said, this is too country. I went, what? And it threw me for a curve. And, you know, when you're young and trying to find your way, a lick like that can shake your confidence, and it shook my vision for a second. But the MCA stuff, Hillbilly Rock, was a song that I didn't think was a hit, but it went on to be a hit, and it gave me a reason to get a bus and a band and some cowboy clothes. I used that first year to just keep exploring. And there was a song that Paul Kittlerney and I wrote called Tempted. Mm-hmm. And I felt like Tempted, we finally found something that was a sonic identity and something that I was proud of and could build on. And that was, to me, the downbeat of the journey was Tempted, the second record.
That's really where you felt.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a Buddy Holly vibe.
Well, let me tell you this. They didn't think it was a hit. They being the promotion department at MCA. And we played a concert in Lubbock, Texas. And I had the song in my pocket. And the speakers will tell you yay or nay a lot of times, right? Mm-hmm. So I went to a radio station in Lubbock and did a pre-show interview. And on the way out of the room, the DJ was cool. I said, would you do me a favor? I said, my record, I have a song in my pocket that I think is a hit, that is a little bit, I can feel Buddy Holly and Roy Orbison and me and all of us in there. I said, would you play it so I could listen to it on the way back to the hotel? He said, sure, no problem. And the DJ played the song, and I turned it up really loud in the vehicle I was in, and it sounded like a hit, and I knew it was a hit. And at the end of it, the DJ said, I think that song would make Buddy Holly proud. And I thought, oh, I'm going to go fight for this song. And I'm glad I did.
Wow. What was it like working for MCA or any record company then? You must have, you know, you grew up with these guys like Johnny Cash, who seemed like such rebels, who seemed to be doing what they wanted, or at least had somebody like Sam Phillips, who was as hard-headed and as rebellious as they are. Are you sitting in a boardroom and you've got somebody from marketing saying, we don't think it's a hit?
I think there's always been that at record labels, but MCA in the early 90s in Nashville was run by Bruce Hinton and Tony Brown. And Bruce was a guy that had as a young executive, had worked under a fellow named Goddard Lieberson here in New York City. Mm-hmm. And Goddardson, in my mind, is still the coolest record guy that ever lived, because he would sign Flat and Scruggs, but he'd also work with Dave Brubeck and all, and he'd do a Broadway show, and he just was a world-class musical citizen and cool. I think he was jazz cool in his heart. But Goddardson understood. And so Bruce Hinton brought a lot of that with him. And Tony Brown, the A&R guy, had trained with the Oak Ridge Boys and gospel quartets. Then he got a job with Emmylou Harris. And then he played with Elvis. And then he stepped out and became a record guy. So you have these two extra cool guys running this label in Nashville. And for a moment in time, MCA Records was the spot on planet Earth to be. They were so cool. The doors were open. Creativity was pouring in. They had mainstream stars like George Strait and Reba McEntire. Up and coming side, they had Lyle Lovett and Vince Gill and me and Patti Loveless and Steve Earle, those kind of acts. And it was just a perfect, cool scenario. And it lasted for a long time. And then, you know, as the country music world started becoming more corporate and more great, you know, entities started buying up record labels. I think Seagram's bought that into things. And so everything changed. But for a moment in time, we had it right.
Mm-hmm. Country music always seems to be going through these ebbs and flows where it gets very corporate, and then suddenly, and it's you were considered a very traditional player. A lot of those people were, Lyle Lovett wasn't, but people sort of bring the older qualities of country music back.
Well, it's funny to me because I started out, going back to those first, like, Columbia records, they were loud, they were rock and roll, and my job was to throw boxes of dynamite into audiences and to shake things up. And the further I got into it, I thought, no, let me turn around here and rethink this, because a lot of people started responding. But when it started clicking, Dwight Yoakam, Steve Earle, and myself, we were kind of at the forefront of taking it to a different place. But there was a thread of tradition in there, but there was still a fresh edge on it, I thought. Mm-hmm. But everything runs its course.
When you look at country music now, what kind of state is country radio in now?
Well, I don't hardly listen. I don't listen to country radio much. I listen to satellite radio, And I work inside a good band, and we're a pretty good radio to listen to ourselves. But I think the thing that is amazing to me, that is absolutely amazing to me, is that people that you didn't know 2 years ago, 3 years ago, can fill up stadiums two nights in a row now with contemporary country music. And my hat's off to them. That is awesome. We need that end of things. That's big business by anybody's standards. But the heart and soul factor is what, you know, starting about 1999 with the Pilgrim, I went, you know what? I've got $150 in two different banks. I'm married to the girl I love. I got a Cadillac that's old with some gas money in my pocket. The world's best Telecaster, some cowboy clothes, and a cool set of cowboy boots. How about I live like I believe now? And so I have friends in every denomination of country music, but the foundational qualities of country music, the timeless place, that's where I finally put my flag in the dirt. Until further notice, you can find me here.
Mm-hmm. Was that a hard decision?
No. The other stuff had run its course. I remember we played Foxwoods. Big old crowd at the end of the 90s. We couldn't have been riding any higher commercially. And I whirled around to do a guitar solo, and I looked at the music I was playing. I heard it, and I saw the effect it was having, and I thought, I'm so sick of this. This became a gag that worked. You know?
The worst kind.
the worst kind. And I thought, I need to find my way back to who I am, to my heart, soul. And that led me to a record called The Pilgrim, which ultimately cost me my record deal. Mm-hmm. But it also put me on the path that I've been on ever since, which is the richest years of my life.
I want to go through all those things you had one by one, but I'm going to start with the guitar. Is this the famous Clarence White B-Bender?
Yeah.
So tell me about that guitar.
I read in something this morning that 40 years ago today, Johnny Cash hosted Saturday Night Live, and Elton John was the musical guest, and John dressed up in some flamboyant outfit and introduced Elton John.
They switched costumes.
Yeah. That was 40 years ago today. Well, what that means to me is 40 years ago today was the first time that I played Clarence White's guitar publicly. It was on Saturday Night Live on that show. I looked like a jumping bean back there. But I bought that guitar from his wife, Susie, and I couldn't believe I had it in my hands. I still can't believe I have it in my hands. But yeah, but that's the guitar.
Is that the guitar you play every night?
Mm-hmm.
And so, as I understand it right, the guitar has a mechanism that bends the B string. Is that right?
Clarence and Gene Parsons, the drummer, they were in the Byrds together. Clarence was an adventurous thinker musically, and so was Gene. And Clarence was trying to play all these steel guitar licks, you know. And he said, why can't we come up with a device that if like you pull down on the strap, it just raises it like a steel guitar pedal. So instead of doing it with your fingers, you pull down on the strap and it goes. That.
Now, does it allow you to do, if you don't have to bend it then, can you do other things? Can you make other sounds with it?
Yeah.
It just allows you more flexibility then?
Yeah,
you can do
well,
the bends and you can do other things around it.
It becomes a whole different vocabulary.
Yeah,
if you listen to songs like Bad Day at Whiskey on Dr. Byrds and Mr. Hyde record, they were experimenting with, you know, psychedelia.
Mm-hmm.
And Clarence had a fuzz pedal. And all these things he was doing, I promise you, if Jimi Hendrix heard it, he would go, wow, I can't do that. But it was the pedal on that guitar that allowed him to do that.
Mm-hmm. So we'd pull it was attached to the strap.
He'd just
pull the guitar down, and he would get, and it would be a full tone.
Yeah.
Amazing. Because most people, when they want that, the steel sound, they do what you do. They just bend.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to learn how to play that?
Oh, I'm still learning. I just want to think. I've really getting something going on that guitar. Somebody would present me with a live show from the Byrds or something Clarence played. I went back to the woodshed.
It would be as if you gave a classical pianist, you said, the piano's the same, except we just reversed all the keys in one octave.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's the same.
Yeah.
It would just mess with you, I would think.
It's a different thing.
Yeah. Now, does Kenny ever play it?
Kenny actually got a, it's called a bender, a B bender.
Right.
Kenny actually got a B bender put on his guitar, and he's getting pretty good at it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But you got the original. You've got the, I think the prototype, wasn't it?
That's the first one. Yeah.
Well, you've got some guitars.
Oh, it's an amazing guitar.
We have to pause quickly for a break, and then we'll be back with more from Marty Stewart and Bruce Hedlum.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
We're back with the rest of Bruce Hedlum's conversation with Marty Stewart.
So tell me about The Pilgrim then. Had you had it with stardom? You'd had it with that, you'd run that race in Nashville?
Back in the early 70s, probably the sweetest spot creatively that I've ever known in Nashville was the early 1970s. And the only comparison I think I could throw out is it was must have been like Paris in the 20s. The old world of country music was kind of fading away, and the outlaw movement was taking place. Willie and Waylon and all those great writers that came around. There was a street called Elliston Place in Nashville. And you were either kind of the old Opry crowd or a part of this New World Order that was kind of setting the woods on fire. But due to my age and the way I looked and what I thought about, as soon as I'd get through with the Grand Ole Opry, you know, I'd change clothes and head to Elliston Place and hang out with the outlaws. And so I saw into a different level of stardom there. I saw into a different level of creativity that wasn't offered, even as precious as that old Opry scene and those people were to me. So I just started dialing my way through that, thinking I'm going to be a star someday, and pretty much decided I'd do whatever it took to get there. And I remember taking a piece of my soul, literally, and putting it under a rock, going, you know, I'll come back to this someday, mm-hmm. who you really are. But just go out there by way of craft, ingenuity, and just perseverance, and get it done, get the job done. Become a star-making machine. And so from the early 70s forward till about that day in Foxwoods we talked about, that's the way I lived. And then one day I thought, I am so sick of this. I have enough money now that I can think the way I want to. I can breathe. And a friend of mine told me at about somewhere along the way during those days, he said, you know, you're getting to the age now, you should never sign up for anything you don't believe in anymore. You got to probably stand by what you believe in. And in my heart of hearts, and I was fried. It was time to call time out and go to the woods. But I remember in my heart going back to that rock that I put myself under and went, let me reconnect with that guy. And the result of that was the Pilgrim. It was a return to heart and soul.
Mm-hmm. And storytelling.
And all of the classic themes, all of the timeless aspects of the music that I love. And it put me in the land of shadows. I was under the shadows of some mighty figures.
Mm-hmm. Who were those figures that inspired you?
On the Pilgrim, when I would write a song, I had an invisible committee in my mind. I thought if I had Johnny Cash and Merle Haggard and Jimmy Rogers, Lester Flatt, Bob Dylan, Tom Petty, and Hank Williams at the table, and I would sing this song to them without wincing, I know I have a song here. So they became my cloud of witnesses that I've kind of, again, carried around in my mind when I was making the Pilgrim, writing the songs.
Mm-hmm. Were you all conscious of the group that Steve Earle had come out of Guy Clark and Townes Van Zandt? Was that part of your thinking, or it was older than that?
A little different side of the street.
Yeah.
They were the Texas boys, and I'm a Mississippi boy, so I loved them, admired them, played music with them, throw John Prine in that pile too. Mm-hmm. They wrote a little bit different kind of song than I was looking for at that time. But, you know, we were all after them. Rodney Crowell, put him in there.
Sure.
But I was aware of them and respected the fire out of their work, but it was a different kind of song I was writing.
Mm-hmm. And then it's almost as though you cast that album. You had different characters. Pam Tillis is on that record. We talked about Emmy Lou. George Jones sings on that record, doesn't he?
Yeah.
What was that? Had you known him before?
Uh-huh. I saw The Pilgrim was basically my love letter to country music. I wanted to create a story that was told with the soundtrack of country music's past, present, and future, starting with the mountain sounds of Ralph Stanley. And that's as deep as you can go. To George Jones' honky-tonk sounds, Emmy Lou, to wind up in contemporary country music land with songs like Dragging Around These Chains of Love. With all these vignettes of people, I just saw it as an opera. And with people coming and going, vignettes. And it was a complicated process, but once I finally got it kind of sliced and diced, the biggest problem I had with that project was the ending. I couldn't come up with an ending. And I was in Austin one day and I bought a piece of stained glass that I carried home on the bus with me and just stuck it in my basement. And one day I was in the basement when I was really trying to figure out this ending, and I saw words at the bottom of the glass, and I brushed it off, and it was a poem by Tennyson. Then move the trees, the copses nod. Wings flutter, voices hover near. O just and faithful knight of God, ride on, the prize is near. So pass I hostile hall and grange, by bridge, by ford, by park, by pale. All armed I ride, whate'er betide, until I find the Holy Grail. And I thought, how about at the end of that you say, said the lonesome pilgrim far from home. And I thought, I need to call 822-5615 and see if John R. Cash will answer me, because he needs to be the voice to end this record. And that's how I found the ending to The Pilgrim on the bottom of a stained glass.
Wow. Tennyson, cowboy poet.
Mm-hmm.
Your next, it wasn't your next big project, but another big project which I loved is Ghost Train. And tell me how that came about.
When the Superlatives and I formed, we set ourselves some standards. First and foremost, I shut the rehearsal down 15 minutes, honestly, into the first rehearsal, and I knew that this was a band unlike anything I'd ever. I started my first band when I was 9, but I knew this band was unlike anything else I had ever done. And I thought, okay, we are musical missionaries or mercenaries, however you want to depend it. This is bigger than chasing 3-minute songs that are disposable up and down Music Row. Let's take our case to the people. Let's figure out who we are out in the woods and then bring it back to town with us. And everybody jumped on board with us and said, if we believe in it, we'll pay to get there. If we don't, you can't afford us. We'll never play it. So with those lofty standards in mind, we didn't have very many people to book us. But we set forth. And I noticed, like, the first record was one more attempt at country radio. It was called Country Music on Columbia. Mm-hmm. Then I got an imprint deal, and we started doing records like Soul's Chapel, which was a tip of the hat to the vanishing sounds of Delta gospel music, Staple Singer style. Badlands, Ballads of the Lakota. We did a live record from the Ryman. But somewhere along the way, I remember saying, I feel like we're honored guests everywhere we go, but we still don't have our thing. We still don't have our mission statement. And one day, 3 words, traditional country music, the vanishing of the culture came forth. I thought, man, we have 15 minutes left before Kitty Wells and Ray Price and Merle Haggard and all of their contemporaries are gone, so let's do something about it. I always admired the Stones. When the Stones got really popular, they shined the light back on Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. Merle Haggard did that early in his career when he got white hot. He shined the light back on Bob Wills and Jimmy Rogers. With that in mind, and I just said, let's make a thing out of traditional country music. And I found us a deal on a TV network called RFD-TV, and we did 156 episodes of a TV show that celebrated that culture and what was left of it. Since the show's been off the air, 43 people and counting have gone. But Ghost Train was one of the records that was in the dead center of that mission. It was taken lost and forgotten, overlooked sounds from Nashville's Studio B great days, and writing new songs around them, and, you know, cutting a couple older songs. But it was about bringing Studio B back to life, where all those hits had been cut. Those sounds that, you know, had been disregarded due to the changing of times, which I knew were timeless. That became Studio B. That became Ghost Train, the Studio B sessions.
Mm-hmm. And you got to sing with your wife?
Connie.
Yeah.
Connie has made 55 records. And her first hit came in 1964, RCA record. It's a song called Once a Day. Mm-hmm. Huge hit. Got her started. But we were standing in the middle of Studio B making this record. And again, it's such a music box. And I thought, I would love to hear Connie's voice in this studio one more time. And I wrote a song with her. And we did it as a duet and included it on that record. And then later, we did a whole record on her in that studio, you know, a couple of years later, that went on to do great things for her. But it was about putting real country music back in, royalty back in that studio. Mm-hmm. And it worked.
Had she performed in that studio before? Has she ever recorded there?
Oh, that's where the first, you know, probably 20 records of her career were done.
Right?
She loved that room. That was her home studio, but she hadn't been there in a lot of years because the studio had closed, and it now operates as a classroom.
Mm-hmm.
But after hours, we went in. After the tours were done and after students were taught, we made it back into a studio. And so, yeah, She loved going back there.
Mm-hmm. And you one of your songs you co-wrote with Johnny Cash is on that record, right? Is Hangman?
Is it Hangman?
Yeah.
That's the last song he ever was a part of.
Is that right?
Yeah. I'd been to Folsom. We played Folsom, California, the city. And I asked if I could go out to the prison and see where they made the record. And the governor of California got me a pass. And they took me out there, and I wanted to see the cafeteria. I knew that's where the record was made. Mm-hmm. And behind the back wall of the cafeteria, they showed me, it served as the common band hall for all the bands that play at Folsom Prison. And the day I was there, it just happened to be the Folsom Country Band. And they let me set in with them, and we played Mama Tried and Folsom Prison.
Oh,
Blues.
Is that right?
Yeah. But right off to that was the hanging gallows where they executed people. And that really got me. All the way back to Nashville, I was thinking about that room. And I thought, okay, what if you were the hangman? What do? You go home and tell your wife you did a great job today? That must be an awful job. And I started this song, and it says, I killed another man today. It's hard to believe. I lost count at 30. I've grown too numb to grieve. The bottle helps me cope when I lay down at night. And when the dope rolls through my veins, it all fades out of sight. Hangman, hangman, that's my stock and trade. Hangman, hangman, sending bad men to their graves. And that's all I had. And so John, we were next door neighbors. I went by to see him before I went on the road, and I was telling him about my experience, and I just quoted those words. I said, that's as far as I can get. And from his wheelchair, he spoke up. He said, who killed who? I asked myself time and time again. God have mercy on the soul of a hangman. I went, well, that took care of that. And
like,
then we wrote,
is somebody recording this?
A
yeah.
Second verse in about 5 minutes. I always loved, he could name people really good. I went, there's a woman down the street. I pointed at him, he went, name Rosalie McFall. I went, Rosalie McFall. She don't ask me any questions when I come to call. Her arms are soft and warm. Her words true and kind. Da, 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 da. I forget the last lines. Da, da, da. And when she holds me in her arms, it all fades out of sight, something like that. But we sit there and wrote that song. And he looked so beautiful that day. He was in his wheelchair, but he had on this black shirt, and the afternoon light was kissing the back of his shirt. He looked like an old president. I had my camera. I said, JR, let me take your picture. And I knew he didn't want me to. He said, all right. So first two frames, he was just kind of slumped. I said, where's Johnny Cash? And he sat up straight, and he looked like an old president. Mm. And I took the picture. On the way out of the room, I sang him a song, or I played him a song that I just recorded of his called The Walls of a Prison. And I sat at his feet, held his ankles. He says, I've never heard you sing that way before. I said, I never felt that way before. He said, excellent, my son. So I stood up and I said, I have to go to Washington. I said, play an East Coast show or two. I said, anything you want? He said, no. And he looked around the room. He says, anything in this room you want? I said, just your love. He said, you got it. And I said, I'll see you when I get home. I said, you got plenty of rope? He said, I got plenty of rope. I said, how's your spirit? He said, good. And 4 days later, he was gone.
Wow.
But we left. We signed off on good terms.
Yeah, that's very good. I'd love to talk about Way Out West and all your other records, but let's talk a little more about Altitude. I haven't even asked you how you write. Are you the kind of guy, do you always have a guitar nearby? Are you writing every day? Are you...
I go months and don't write sometimes. I've also been guilty of getting out of the shower and taking a can of shaving cream and squirting it all over the mirror and writing with my finger because I knew that was a good line. I never know. You know, you write, so you never know when it's going to strike.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out of the whole traditional country music mission and doing all that I thought that I looked and went, mission accomplished. I knew we needed to turn the wheel. So I called my buddy Mike Campbell after writing a record called Way Out West. I went, I want to make a cosmic country music record. It's time to go to the desert and let it fly. And so we did. And Way Out West record did a lot of cool things for our band. I felt the needle turn, the wheel turn. And when it was time to start making music for a new record beyond Way Out West, these songs just kept coming that felt like they were kindred to an extension of Way Out West. And again, just inspired by all those things we'd been doing on the road. And just song after song started coming. And I write my best. I tend to love to write most on the road. I love writing on the bus, going down the road, looking out at America to the left and the right.
I said earlier, a great sounding record. You know, it starts with your Lost Bird Space Train instrumentals. There's two or three of them on the record. They sound great. And
that goes back to scoring films. And Pilgrim taught me a lot about that, too, about pacing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when there's two slow songs back to back and they don't quite flow, an instrumental helps. And me and my band, we all grew up listening to instrumentals. And there used to be a lot of instrumental records made in Nashville. So we can pick, so we write instrumentals. So it's nice to me in the journey, in the listening experience, if an instrumental can carry you forward. So that's what that's about.
Sitting Alone, you may not have grown up with the Beatles. That sounds like a George Harrison song to me. That's got a great, great guitar piece. And Space has did you actually use a sitar on Space?
Yeah. Well, there's an electric sitar.
Yeah, but you use an East Indian...
Country and Eastern music, what do you think?
I liked it. Well, because you use the East Indian scale, too, so it's got that flat sixth.
Some of the shows we were doing with Steve Miller, Steve has a beautiful song that he does called Wild Mountain Honey that features a sitar. I have to tell you, I think I have one of those in my warehouse somewhere, and I found it, probably hadn't seen it two times in 20 years, and I pulled it out and started goofing around, and the next thing I know, here comes Space.
Do you often switch instruments to try and get a new way of writing? Do you ever write on the mandolin, for example?
Yeah, and I'm looking at two guitars in this room right now. Both guitars have personalities, and I think if you're trying to write a song, they would encourage you into a certain kind of lyric or melody. So there's stuff down in here.
Mm-hmm. The last song I do want to ask you about is The Angels Come Home, which is, it's an album full of feedback and great sonic effects, and suddenly you're playing the acoustic with a little bit of accompaniment at the end. Can you tell me about that song?
I was at an awards show, and you know how those shows tend to go. Everybody tries to outdo everybody. They will, you know, if it's not pyrotechnics, it's a choir. It's just, you know, it's just everybody. It's all about the 3 minutes your artist gets and your act, you as an act you get. And I was at one of those, and I was just beat to death about, and it has nothing to do with music usually, you know.
Mm.
And in the midst of all this, this singer-songwriter came out with a guitar wearing a flannel shirt and sang a song. And you could hear a pin drop in the room, and everybody's heart just melted. And it reminded me that the truth inside of a song, simply presented, unadorned, from the heart, has more power than everything else put together. And The Angels Came Down is one of those songs that I felt like, you know, this whole record was about, you know, swirling around in the spirit world, or, you know, cosmic this, cosmic that. And the spirit world probably is the most cosmic of all places. And the angels, if you believe in them, which I do, you know, I know there's times in my life that I felt like I've had a hand in being rescued from dark moments and dark ways of life. And that song's probably the most autobiographical thing on the record. And I thought, well, back to the guy in the flannel shirt at the end of all the hoopla, come out and tell the truth, see what happens.
Was there a particular time in your life that song was about, or just about
the... Oh, good Lord. You know, I was a rock and roll knucklehead lifestyle from about 1973 when Lester Flatt started playing hippie shows. So I finally crashed and burned two or three times. I went, okay, it's time to grow up, deal with this, get sober, and do something about it. And that became a way of life for me about 20 years ago, and I've enjoyed every second of it since then.
When I heard the song, it almost sounded like it was a song about death, though, that the angels were coming down for you.
Well, when that time comes, we all have that in common, that will happen to each and every one of us. You know, it's just fine with me if a herd of angels come take me by the hand and lead me on.
If you have to go.
If you have to go. But I'm married to an angel, so there you go.
All right. Well, it's already it's happening every day then.
Yeah, you bet.
Thank you so much.
It's Bruce, thank you.
Just a great treat and another great record.
Thank you kindly.
Yeah.
Thanks for all you're doing. You're keeping the real stuff alive.
I hope so. I hope so. And thank you.
Thanks to Marty Stewart for sharing all those great stories and memories from his illustrious career. You can hear all of our favorite Marty Stewart songs on a playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose and Eric Sandler. Our show is engineered by Echo Mountain. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like this show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora. To inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, MUSORA.com, to start a new musical journey today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.